is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. This is the 20th year of welfare reform, or what some of us refer to as welfare deconstruction and destruction. April McCrae thought she had finally caught a break in late 2005. That's when the state of Louisiana granted cash assistance to the single mother through the Temporary Assistance of Needy Families, or TANF, program. It was her first experience with America's welfare program. McCrae, who had been in and out of work, struggled to make ends meet. This, she hoped, would at least help soften the burden. But a month later, the state stripped her of the benefits without a clear explanation, she said. Since then, she says, Louisiana, which controls state and federally allocated TANF dollars, has denied her request for assistance several times. It gets depressing, said McCrae, who in 2016 is still struggling with three kids and rarely more than a part-time job. April says she needs help she can't seem to get from a welfare system that was overhauled 20 years ago. As far as whether people are better off, I don't think so. In most cases, I think they're worse off.
20 years ago on April 22nd, then-President Bill Clinton signed the Welfare Reform and Construction Law that imposed work requirements and term limits on public assistance into effect, and people like April McCrae across the country have been left destitute.
There are advocates who, in the wake of the shredding of the social safety net, such as those in New York who are demanding an end to the Work Experience Program, WEP, increased allowances to reflect the cost of living, and more humane treatment at public assistance centers for the millions of poor women like April McCrae and their children across the nation.
But like April McCrae, we're left to wonder why across the spectrum those seeking electoral office and why their platforms fail to meaningfully address poverty and seek to reverse 20 years of the harmful legacies of the 1990s Welfare Reform and Destruction Act.
So let's put this question to Felicia Kornbluh, author of the forthcoming Ensuing Poverty, The History and Politics of Welfare Reform. Felicia Kornbluh is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont, and she's also authored The Battle for Welfare.
Delighted to be here.
So let's begin with that very question, which is, why is there such reticence and difficulty? And first, let's start with the Clinton administration. Since Hillary Clinton professes to be a feminist, this is an issue primarily, first and foremost, about women. And she was formative in the 20 years ago deconstruction of welfare as we know it. And it was under Bill Clinton's presidency. So why are we hearing nothing about what is to be done?
I think Hillary Clinton has good reasons to not want to talk about the issue. She would rather not reopen this particular can of worms. And it's very interesting because so many of the other policies of the early and mid-90s, so many policies of the Clinton administration have now come under question and reexamination. And suddenly, things that it seems like we couldn't talk about before 2016, suddenly we are talking about, I think, thanks to Bernie Sanders, thanks to a lot of popular forces, thanks to Black Lives Matter, we are talking about the Crime Bill of 1994, and we are talking about NAFTA and about the endorsement of trade deals that weren't good for many American workers and that were opposed by the labor movement. But we haven't really talked very much, at least in the mainstream, about welfare reform, and I think Hillary would rather kind of let that sit. I don't know if I could say that she was formative herself. I think it's certainly fair to say she did not object. And there were others, including many longtime friends and allies of hers, including Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund, which Hillary had been on the board of for many years. There were others, including Wright Edelman, who did object very vociferously. And Hillary certainly did not join them in objecting. So I think now she would just like it if we would all kind of forget about welfare reform and just not talk about it.
Felicia, let's get more into detail about what the effects of this so-called reform was in 1996 that they called welfare reform.
Well, the main aspects of the changed law, of the new law, were that time limits were introduced to welfare receipt for the first time in our history. We started as a country providing these benefits at the national level in 1935 with the Social Security Act, and then we started providing them at the state and municipal level early in the 20th century. And really, it's a continuation of programs that go back to, you know, the 17th century or to even parish based relief in England, you know, in the medieval and early modern period. So this is it's a very old principle that when you're destitute and in times of need, your community will provide for you. And it's very, very old that the people who are going to need that provision are overwhelmingly disabled people and women with young children. So for the first time, our country said in 1996, there's a time limit. So you can only get these benefits for 5 years for the entirety of your life, no matter how many kids you are, no matter what your circumstances are, et cetera. And there was a little bit of provision at the margins for people who might have trouble, women who were victims of domestic violence, for example. In certain states, not even in every state, but in certain states, there's an option, a family violence option, to recuse women from that time limit. And then the other piece of it was a work requirement. After 2 years on the rolls, a maximum of 2 years, and in some states it's much less, but after a maximum of 2 years, if you're receiving financial benefits from the government under this TANF program, then you also need to be engaged in some market work. So raising your kids isn't enough. Going to school or training is not enough. You also need to be doing some market work. So those were the key things. And it was kind of an extension of what had been going on before, but it was also a very dramatic shift that occurred in 1996. And what was most remarkable about it probably was that it was signed by a Democratic president who some people think is a liberal.
Felicia, before we get into the fact that it is time to end this version of welfare as we know it, I want to just get people disavowed of the notion that there is not a systemic reason that women and their children are the ones that are the poorest sector of our society. So help take us through a kind of history that lets us understand why women have been left in such an impoverished state and why we think it is the responsibility of the state to deal with the kind of abject poverty that they are confronted with in the form of a social service network and safety net system.
In some ways, this is a difficult issue for feminists, and I consider myself a strong feminist, but it's a kind of feminism that of course understands, in a liberal framework, understands women's autonomy, that we have to respect women's autonomy and that women, you know, should be free to make their own choices just as all other citizens are. But we also recognize that women historically have had and continue to have primary responsibility for raising children. So the kind of feminism that I'm interested in, a class-sensitive feminism, what I think of as a reality-sensitive feminism, which is also a racially-sensitive feminism, is a feminism that recognizes that overwhelmingly women in our society are given and themselves kind of take up the primary responsibility for raising children. And because that's true, and because it's been true for many, many years, that imposes certain financial obligations in addition to obligations to do the work of caring for children. So it is work. It is work that many people love and to which many people give their lives, or significant parts of their lives. And as a society, we don't do a very good job of respecting that work. So what the old welfare system used to do really inadequately and really partially, but at least did it, was recognize that there were going to be women raising kids without the benefit of male partners, husbands or lovers, for a variety of reasons, and that they were going to be doing that socially valuable work and that they needed some kind of a floor under them economically. And since 1996, I feel like we've been living in a kind of weird fantasy world. And my terrible suspicion is that a kind of bourgeois feminism, an upper class, generally white women's feminism, has helped to obscure the fact that women still are disproportionately raising kids, and that that does produce certain kinds of economic consequences and need for women and children who are in these very, very impoverished families.
Lisa, you've been talking about this for many, many years, but unfortunately, many, many other people have not been talking about it, even now during the current electoral cycle. Why do you think that is?
Well, my co-author, Gwendolyn Mink, and I have described it as kind of the hole in the middle of the donut in our politics. And I don't mean to be cutesy about that, but I think it's just been really interesting. If we just look at people on the Democratic side of things, I mean, the Republicans are, they're doing their own politics. But just on the Democratic side, I was in some ways very inspired by Bernie Sanders' campaign. I'm from Vermont. I voted for Sanders in the primary. Sanders really is most comfortable with a kind of old-fashioned, social democratic, class-based politics. And his general approach is that if we pursue policies like universal health care, right, single payer, we sometimes call it government health care, that that will help everyone. It'll help women, and it'll help people of color, and it'll help everybody, right? So that's what we need to do, is we need to pursue those policies, which are class-sensitive, but not gender-sensitive or racially-sensitive or anything like that. We need to reach the most people, right? And then Hillary Clinton has been pursuing a politics which is kind of gender sensitive and racially sensitive, and at least at the level of saying, like, I'm a woman and it makes a difference when a woman is making policy. And to some degree, she has talked about care work in certain limited ways, and, you know, in terms of reform she's proposed in the social security system and stuff like that. But she's really not talking about issues of class and about the things that are facing working people, or even more, people who are not working, who are really, really in trouble these days, right? So we wind up with, you know, two interesting and in some ways productive kinds of politics, but neither one is reaching the situation of low-income women of color, or even low-income white women, who many of whom find themselves in really desperate situations today. And somebody's got to fill that gap. Neither politics is really going to do the trick.
So what you're saying is that, and I know you've called it this economic universalism that proceeds as though gender doesn't matter, it proceeds as though race doesn't matter. It kind of subjugates or subordinates those special considerations which have a history and a presence of their own. So if you're doing a kind of generic one size fits all, in fact, it fits none.
So, yeah, in the United States, I think we just can't do that politics. We can't start in 2016 and say, wipe the slate clean. We just won't talk about race. We just won't talk about gender. I think it doesn't work. And if we try and create a universalistic politics and we don't talk about people's particular needs and histories, then I think we're going to wind up doing harm. We're going to wind up leading people out.
So then the Democratic platform should certainly restore income support for low-income caregivers. And I wonder if you can expound on that. Definitely there are things like reform things. The work requirements should be eliminated. The time limits should be eliminated. The sanctions, which in New York there is currently a moratorium on, but they're going to be restored in September, albeit with some tooling around the edges so they won't be as oppressive. But what is to be done that would make a system that is more conducive to the needs of and more responsive to women and children who are the primary people who are poor within our society?
Maybe this is the good news. We don't have to look very far to think about how we could create a much more humane and workable system. What if, for example, we took the old age insurance program that we usually call Social Security as our model? Old age insurance, you know, was created at the same time as the old welfare program. It was created in 1935. It was just a different part of the same law. right? Old age insurance was for older Americans who had had certain kinds of work histories, and the old welfare program was for low-income women and children. But they always were set up differently. They were administratively different, and it was always much harder for women and children to get access to their benefits than it was for older or retired Americans to get access to their benefits. But what if we just followed that Social Security model? So then it would be a nationally administered program. It wouldn't be subject to local and state-level control and all the abuses that are introduced that there. It also wouldn't be so expensive to administer if it was run by the federal government. We could just do some kind of simple income eligibility check and then, you know, send people their checks in the mail without the kind of massive bureaucracy that we have now to check people's eligibility constantly. And we make women and children wait around in the welfare office for hours and hours and hours. You know, we could get rid of time limits with a stroke of a pen, with the stroke of congressional action. We could get rid of time limits. And instead of imposing these onerous work requirements, we could make work voluntary. You know, what we found out in the 1980s in states like Massachusetts, when they had a voluntary work program for women who were receiving welfare benefits, the program was completely full. It's not that women don't want to work. You know, they're just facing a mismatch in a labor market that, first of all, doesn't have enough jobs, and it certainly doesn't have enough good jobs. You know, so why not just make it voluntary? And then the other thing is give people genuine opportunities. People want opportunities. People want to go to school. Right now, if you're receiving welfare benefits, and you want to go back and get some kind of a degree, even a vocationally oriented degree, it's almost impossible. You know, I read these stories of women taking 3 buses with their kids and, you know, creating some kind of a daycare system. And then they find out that the education program isn't covered. It's not considered an appropriate education program under the terms of their welfare receipt, or they're only allowed to be in a program for such a short amount of time that they can't get any decent kind of vocational training, to say nothing of, you know, really meaningful basic education. It's just crazy. It's the whole thing is just a farce of opportunity. We have the word opportunity in the law. We're not providing people any opportunities, and we could. We really could do it.
Some people may say this sounds really radical, but there are precedents for this in our history. Even the Republicans at some point were on board for something like this. So is this such a departure from the past?
I don't think it is. I think we could see it as a renewal of some of our basic values. As I was saying a little bit ago, the roots of this policy really are very, very old in England and in the United States, and probably also in the other countries that that sent people to these shores in the 17th and 18th centuries. I just don't know those histories as well. But certainly in England and the U.S., you know, it's a very normal thing that we provide for women and children in times of need. What's extraordinary is that we now operate in a kind of fantasy world that people don't need this kind of assistance. And of course, you know, we've never done it great. We've never been as generous as we could be or as we should be. And we can do better than that. One thing I think about a lot is both in the 1970s and today, a lot of people call for a basic income that wouldn't just be for moms and kids. It would be for everybody. And I'm also very moved by that idea. And, you know, sounds radical in some ways, but it's actually pretty easy to do. And it makes a lot of sense. There are a lot of people in Silicon Valley and elsewhere calling for this because they know that in our highly technological society, there's just going to be a lot of unemployment, you know, and there's no reason for us to demand that everyone be in the labor market. It's just nutty that we think that the only way that you can kind of earn the right to live on this earth is by performing waged labor, no matter what kind of waged labor that would be. So then we wind up like resisting new technology and resisting more efficient factories or whatever. Like, why, you know, why as a society should we be putting ourselves in that position? So, you know, if we have to do it in a way that's universal and we give everybody basic income, let's just make sure that we're also providing adequately for mothers and children, and that we're also providing adequately for communities of color that have been kind of left out of the resource race up to this point.
Well, one of the things that you point out in your writing is the outsized rate of single mother poverty, nearly 40% in 2014, which should command our attention. It hasn't really. And I'm interested in your thoughts about paid family leave, a higher minimum wage, equal pay, accessible child care. Are these the issues that we should be directing our attention to, or in some ways do those also attenuate the specific inequalities that make and keep so many single mothers poor?
Yes, I believe that we should pursue all of those things, and we should, you know, we should do them all at once. I would caution anyone who thinks that we could make the problem of single mother poverty go away with a good child care system, for example. I would just caution people about that. I think there is a role, and there will continue to be a role, for cash assistance. And that's in some ways, that's the hardest nut for us as a culture. Giving people cash in times of need. It's really fine. It's morally fine to do that. It makes a lot of sense. People need it. And as we've seen since 1996, the big finding since 1996 is when we take the cash away, we really do create misery. We really do reduce people's lifespans. We really do reduce their health. You know, not just their access to health care. We reduce their actual lived experience. We reduce their health. And we've been doing that as a culture, and we need to stop doing it. Giving people food stamps is not good enough. Giving people services is not good enough. People need cash.
One of the things that you point out, again, in your writing is that, and really it deserves to be said again, that women are, for so many reasons, overrepresented in the least well-paid professions with the most limited access to decent family-supporting benefits. The issue of women's poverty is a systemic one ingrained in the cultural reality of this country. And it needs to be said more aggressively to counter the mythologies of those women who are on public assistance, are recipients, who, of course, we had terms in the past like welfare queens, etc., to connote a kind of complacency and laziness, as though the state was doling out something that was otherwise undeserved and was opportunistically sought. So take us out of that terrible kind of mythology that I dare say too many people certainly still have, and most decidedly within the Republican Party camp.
I think you're pointing out something which is important, which is that many women, including many mothers, are in the labor market right now, and many want to be. And so we need to expand our brains, I think, enough to understand that sexism and racism and I guess what we could call class subordination, that exists in the labor market and exists outside the labor market for people who aren't in the labor market or who aren't in the labor market very much, right? And to some degree, we need different strategies. I mean, I think we need some kind of a class and race-sensitive basic income regardless. But we may also need really specific policies that will raise wages to an adequate level and do that nationally. And we need policies that support people who are in the labor market. Of course, we need a decent, and I would say, universal system of child care comparable to the ones that they have in many Western European countries. You know, it seems like they're all able to afford it. We can afford it. We do need a system of paid family leave so that when people have children biologically or when they adopt children, they don't suffer such terrible poverty that it winds up, you know, being a kind of disciplinary thing and keeping people at work when they really feel like they need to be home with their young children. You know, I think we need to work on both fronts. We need to work on the labor market front, and we need to remember that there are people who are not in the labor market, and remember, as a society, we do not need to force them into the labor market.
Well, Felicia, we Thank you. And I really do encourage people to read the Battle for Welfare Rights, which Felicia is an author of, along with Gwendolyn Mink. And there is, of course, the forthcoming book, which we will get you back for soon, which is Ensuring Poverty, the History and Politics of Welfare Reform, 20 years of deconstruction, really, and tearing apart, shredding the safety net. Thanks for giving us a sense of how we can reform that. What are the issues behind welfare deconstruction? And most critically, what a society that is truly about women's values and women would look like financially to support those who are the most impoverished sector of our society. So again, Felicia Kornbluh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for your work.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.